What's going on? Welcome back to the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. I have a great episode for you today with Mike Matthews. He's a really good friend and colleague of mine. He's also the owner of Legion Athletics, which is the only supplement company I've used for many, many, many years. And we discuss a lot in this conversation, but two of the most important and relevant discussions in this conversation are, number one, how much muscle can you expect to build in the first year, 2 years, 3 years, and throughout your entire training career? We talk about this from both the male and female perspective, so assuming you are not taking anabolic steroids and assuming you're training consistently and getting good sleep and your nutrition is in check, how much muscle can you actually realistically expect to build? Which I thought that was a really good conversation because so many fitness marketers lead people astray with outlandish claims of build 30 pounds of muscle in 30 days and blah, blah, blah. So we wanted to break down exactly what you can expect assuming you're doing everything right. And we also talk about fat burners because, as I said, Mike is the owner of Legion Athletics. As you know, if you've heard me for a while, I'm not a fan of fat burners, and Mike does sell fat burning pills in the Legion supplement line, which I have never taken and I don't plan to take, but I wanted to address that. I wanted to ask him why he sells them, why as a science-based professional he actually believes in them, what he puts in them, and this way you can hear us have this conversation between the two of us, who even though we're great friends, we do tend to disagree on this topic, and I wanted you to hear both of our thoughts on it so you could make the decision for yourself. So with that said, let's get into the episode. All right, Mike, we're live, man. How's it going?
Pretty good. Thank you for asking, and thank you for having me back on the show. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, man. So the last time we spoke, we had a big conversation about supplements. I'll put a link to that podcast in the show notes. Really quickly, before we dive into the whole episode, could you just do me a favor, introduce yourself in case there are people who don't know who you are or what you do? I know you have the Muscle for Life book coming out. I believe you said January 11th. You want to tell them about that? Just give a little introduction to you and the book and what's going on in your life.
Yeah. So let's see. I'm Mike and I do fitness things. That's usually my answer. And people are like, oh, so what do you do? I'm like, you know, I do fitness things. Like, what do you mean? I have some books and, you know, a sports nutrition company. But I guess I would say I most identify as an educator. At least that's the work that I like to do the most. I like to learn stuff and I like to digest it and I like to teach other people and I like to write. And so I continue to do that. And that's how I got started. And so I have this this new book coming out in January. It's actually my first traditionally published book. All of my stuff up until now has been self-published. And so I'm working with Simon & Schuster on this book. It's called Muscle for Life. And I guess the little quick elevator pitch on it is, over the years I've worked with, I mean, really it's tens of thousands of people virtually. You know, my inbox, it's certainly, I'd have to look, it's over 200,000 emails sent and received. And at least 2/3 of those are, I guess on the receive side, there's some spam there, but you know, I've spent a lot of time, communicating with a lot of people. And so I've seen a lot and I know, you know, firsthand, what works and what doesn't. And what I've seen is that the biggest struggle for many people is getting started. It's gaining enough momentum to reach that virtuous circle phase of fitness where you achieve significant results and then that motivates you to keep going and that leads to even better results and so on. You know, I've said many times that if you can get the first 12 weeks right, you are probably going to get the first 12 months right. And if you can get the first 12 months right, you will know exactly how to get the first 12 years right. And that overcoming of inertia, though, that is particularly difficult in my experience for people who are in their 40s and beyond, many people who think it's too late to get into shape or get into great shape even. And in many cases, these people have a lot of weight to lose and they're very unfit and it's hard for them to find their stride. And the good news is research shows that it is never too late to gain muscle, to lose fat, to get healthy. I mean, people can literally start in their 70s, in their 80s, this has been shown in studies, and gain muscle, lose fat, get healthier, get stronger. And so Muscle for Life is the book that really, I think it's going to have the broadest appeal because my existing books are more for I would say they skew younger and a more kind of hardcore crowd, whereas Muscle for Life is it's the 20% that produces 80% of the results, and it's mm-hmm. specifically written for people who are brand new to all of this and who just need that. They need that program that is going to get them up and running, going to help them gain that momentum, so then they can be self-reliant from there on out.
I love that, and it's for both men and women, right?
Good point. Yes, it's for men and women. And the book is written specifically for the 40 plus crowd. I would say there are some exceptions where younger people, where if a younger person came to me and said, let's say it's a 20-year-old, right? And they have 100 pounds to lose or minimally 50 pounds to lose. They've never done any sort of resistance training or strength training. I wouldn't necessarily, whether it's a guy, I wouldn't necessarily say, hey, just go do my Bigger, Leaner, Stronger program, because that mm-hmm. program is immediately going to ask them to squat, deadlift, bench press, overhead press. Or if it's a woman, I wouldn't necessarily send her right into my Thinner, Leaner, Stronger program. What I've done in the past is when I've heard from these people, like when they've emailed me, I have a whole bunch of canned responses because I get a lot of similar questions. And that canned response explains that, okay, so here's what we should do. You read this book so you understand how diet works. You understand how your metabolism works. You understand how flexible dieting works. And then on the training side of things, you will understand the big levers that you can pull and the big buttons you can push to improve your body composition. But let's not start with the program exactly as it's laid out in the book. We are going to start with something a little bit, it's going to be challenging, but it's going to be a little bit less difficult. Let's work you up to that program. And so that was the workaround that I've always had. And this book now is going to be the perfect book to give to those people where I can just say now, you can start with there are three different programs in the book for men and women: beginner, intermediate, and advanced. And the advanced program is kind of like a little bit less difficult version of my Bigger, Leaner, Stronger and Thinner, Leaner, Stronger. And then it also explains how people can assess their current level of fitness and then choose the program that's right for them. So this would be a perfect book also for that person, who has a lot of weight to lose and has never done any of this stuff before. And it's a gradual, enjoyable on-ramp to the more difficult stuff that can help you reach the highest levels of fitness.
I love that. That's awesome. And it's called Muscle for Life, out January 11th. Let me ask you a question, because I'm sure you
to jump in and mention one other thing. Right now I'm doing a whole book launch bonanza, you know, where I'm giving away over $12,000 of stuff and free bonus material for anybody, bonus gifts for people who pre-order. And so depending on when this goes live, that is going to be running all the way up until the release date of Jan 11. And people can learn about that at muscleforlifebook.com. And like, they can enter by buying the book and forwarding their receipt to an email that is on, you know, we explain everything on the page, how to do it. They can get more entries by spreading the word, by following me on social media, just making it fun.
Nice. That's awesome. I love that. I'm sure you get this question all the time. I get it daily, especially when I do Q&As. One of the most common questions I get is, how much muscle can an individual realistically gain? And just hearing like Muscle for Life, I wanted to talk about that. So could you talk about from both a male and a female perspective, what a realistic amount of muscle someone can expect to gain, maybe month over month and then year over year, what that might look like?
Yeah, and I like this question. Oh, by the way, Jordan, I'm hearing an echo.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Weird. I think everything's plugged in okay.
Let's see. It's got to be coming from your end, right? Because I have headphones in.
Have you been hearing it the whole time?
No, it just started and now it went away. Okay.
All right.
We're fine. Anyways, I'll answer the question. I just wanted to let you know, cause I didn't know if it was messing up on your end, you know?
Yeah. No, sounds good on my end.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's one that I'm asked fairly often. It is something that I've written a bit about, spoken a bit about on my podcast. which is called Muscle for Life, by the way. and I've also posted about it on Instagram to give people the reason why I think it is very important is because it has everything to do with expectations. And if you go into this fitness thing, particularly strength training, bodybuilding, even though many people may not think about it as bodybuilding, but if you're wanting to gain muscle and gain strength, if you have the wrong expectations, you are going to be setting yourself up for failure. So if you are just scrolling around on Instagram and you're seeing all these jacked guys and gals and thinking that you will be able to get as jacked and that you will be able to do it in a couple of years maybe, then you can try and actually do quite well by realistic objective standards, but think you are not doing well. And so to directly answer your question, then we can get into the details. Your average guy, and by average, I just mean average muscle building genetics and anatomy. And so not someone who has always been really big and really strong. For example, we all knew those kids growing up. A lot of them ended up on the football team, right? The kid who was obviously going to be the lineman because at 16 he's 6'2", 250. Not those people. I have average muscle building genetics. I've always been on the taller end. I'm about 6'2", but when I started lifting when I was 17 or 18, I was 155 pounds. Now I've always had my weight has always been oddly lower than you would think looking at me. So I didn't look malnourished, but I played ice hockey. So I just looked like, a skinny-ish kind of maybe a little bit fit-ish normal dude, right? And so your average guy is going to be able to gain somewhere around probably, let's say 35 to 45 pounds of muscle over the course of his lifetime, period. Very few guys naturally, I will add, very few guys are naturally going to be able to go much further than that. Again, you are going to have your freaks, your outliers who will be able to gain 50, 55 pounds of muscle, maybe. I mean, unclear, but I would accept that there are those people out there. They're just very rare. And again, those were people who were always big and strong. If you look at Ronnie Coleman, the famous bodybuilder, when he was a teenager, he was huge. Dude, at 13, yeah. I have an image that I probably will never forget because when I first saw it, I couldn't believe it. At 13, he was more jacked than I was after 2 years of weightlifting at 20. I'm not kidding. He had bigger arms, bigger everything, and was leaner at 13 than I was at 20 after lifting weights for 2 years. You look at him, the next picture of him I saw was, it was a high school picture of him playing football. I mean, he was in his uniform, and this is, so I don't know, he's like 17, 18 years old, huge, bigger than I am now at 37 after lifting weights for 20 years. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. And he himself, he openly said that he started using drugs. I believe he said at about 23, 24, 25, something like that. And so if we take him at his word, which, I mean, he did admit to using them, it'd be a little bit odd for him to lie about the timing, right? So he was open about using them. And then if you go look at pictures of him around that time, again, freak. Yeah. You would not believe natural. Very rare though. Very, very rare. I mean, he is one of the greatest bodybuilders of all time, was what we're talking about, right? So average guy, again, call it 35 to 45 pounds of muscle. And some people, when they hear that, it's almost like a letdown. Like they don't realize though, think of a 16 ounce steak, right? That's a pound of muscle. And then put 35 to 45 of them on your body all around. Your body. That's what we're doing, right? But, okay.
That's a good visual. That's a
yeah.
Very
you see that and you're like, all right, that's actually a lot of mass, bro. You know what I mean? and as far as how that breaks down in terms of time. So again, let's just, let's give a range for men. Then we'll talk women. So for men, you're looking at something around probably 15 to 20 pounds of muscle gain in the first year. All of that, of course, it's not going to be exclusively lean muscle tissue. There's going to be extra water and extra glycogen, a form of carbohydrate in the muscles, but it would register if you were to get a DEXA scan, all that would register as lean mass. So 15 to 20 pounds in year one is a good year one. That's going to require not perfection. None of this ever requires perfection. We just have to be good enough most of the time in with our diet and with our training. And then year two is about half of that. So a good year two for men is probably around 10 pounds of muscle gain. That would be a good year two, give or take a couple of pounds, depending on how well we do what we are supposed to do in the kitchen, in the gym, and how well our body responds to the training. And then year three, it halves again. So now you're looking at 5-6-ish pounds of muscle gain. And it really just halves every year from there on out. And I know that sounds almost too elegant to be true, but it has been shown in quite a bit of research. A lot of smart people have spent a lot of time going over the records of many different bodybuilders, especially before steroids were as prevalent. If you look into Dr. Casey Butts and his work and the correlation between total skeleton mass and total muscle building potential, it's an interesting predictor is just how big are your bones. Like I'm somebody, for example, small wrists, small ankles. I was not made to be a big guy. And so that's how it plays out. And then if you start doing that math, you see that, okay, so we, after 5 to 7 years of proper training, proper eating, now the returns are getting vanishingly small. And that is exactly what happens if again, we're talking about natural weightlifting. After 5 to 7 years of doing it right, you are going to gain most of the muscle and strength that you will ever gain. Not all, especially on strength, you can keep going and you can keep gaining muscle. It's just in small amounts and it's slow going and you have to work very hard for it. And so that's men. And I'll stop there if you wanted to follow up with questions before I talk women, or I can just go right into talking.
No, jump right into women.
Cool. So with women, it's pretty simple actually, because you take the male numbers and you cut them in half, basically. So your average woman who is going to respond relatively well to training and do everything that you're supposed to do relatively well, she will be able to gain 10 to at most maybe 15 pounds. Again, there will be outliers, but let's just say in that range, 10 to 15 pounds of muscle in her first year. And then her second year is about half of that. And it proceeds in the same way as with men. And so then what we're looking at with women is that the total amount of muscle gain over the lifetime is going to be probably in the range of 20 to 25 pounds of muscle gain. Some women a little bit less, some women a little bit more. And that's good news though for most women, because once they start doing this for a little bit, they realize that for the body that they want, it usually requires, most women I've worked with, call it 15 pounds, maybe 20 of muscle in the right areas. Most women I've worked with, it takes them more time and more muscle development in their lower body to get that what the way they want versus their upper body. Whereas in men, it's usually the other way around.
Yeah.
And so that's really how it plays out. And strength is something also we could touch on quickly if you wanted to.
Yeah, I was actually just going to say, it's interesting. A lot of people always ask me, like, how come it's so much easier to gain strength early on in strength training and it gets harder and harder and harder as you go? And obviously, strength is a skill and there are neurological adaptations as well. But if you think about it purely from the muscle growth perspective, if you see that you're adding way more in that first year than in any other year thereafter, you can start to see why it might be easier to build strength as well or in the early stages of training.
Correct. Yep. So there's the skill component, and we are going to gain most of our skill probably in the first 6 to 8 months, unless we are going to get really into this stuff where you're going to compete and you are really honing in your technique, because that's the difference of, when you're loading the bar with 105% of your one rep max, that's the difference of getting the rep and not getting it. But for most people, for the purposes of just getting fit, building muscle, getting strong by anyone's standards, maybe not competition strong, but getting strong, we are going to gain most of our skill probably in the first 6 to 8 months, and we will refine it from there on out. But as far as how much that skill is going to impact our strength, we see most of that in the first 6 to 8 months. And then there aren't there aren't too many, there's just not much more meaningful skill gains, quote unquote, to be had. And particularly with squatting, deadlifting, bench pressing, overhead pressing, Olympic lifting would be probably a little bit different because that is a lot more technically demanding.
Right.
But the basic barbell movements are sure they are technical, but they're not that hard to learn. It's not a snatch. So the
biggest learning curve is probably within the first 2 weeks, realistically. And then once you get the hip hinge or you get the squat, you get that movement, then from there it's just minor tweaks.
Yep. And then many people, what they also experience is as the weights start to get heavy, they feel like they have to recalibrate their mm-hmm. technique. They have to get used to the heavier weights. They have to get used to maintaining good form as they get deeper into sets. But yeah, you just naturally learn that stuff. And for anybody listening, a really simple tip is whenever you're trying to learn something, feedback is crucial. And so in this case, it's very easy to get a little tripod for your phone. It doesn't have to even you can get the little ones. I use it for just recording my workouts to post on social media, and it just has these little articulated arms that are probably, 8 inches long, right? So you can just set it up somewhere and record from a couple different angles, from a three-quarter, from a side would probably be helpful, like a squat, for example, and just look at your form and compare it to a good model. Compare it to someone like Jordan, for example, and just look and see, hey, is there anything that I'm doing that either I just know theoretically I shouldn't be doing? Like, for example, most people listening, they probably know that when you're coming out of the hole in a squat, you don't want to shoot your hips up and keep your shoulders level and then kind of lever the barbell up. You want your hips and your shoulders to be rising at the same pace. And when the weights are heavy or heavier and you're getting deeper into sets, it can be hard to know what you're actually doing. Often what you think you're doing is not what you're really doing. And getting on camera can really help with that. And it helps you just connect your awareness of your action with objectively what you're doing.
And for anyone who's like, there's no way in hell I'm ever bringing a tripod into the gym, I film all my workouts too, and I just prop my phone up against my water bottle.
There you go. That you can do that as well.
People are like, I'm never bringing a tripod. I'm like, fine, just prop it up. Like, I don't care. Grab a dumbbell, put it up against the dumbbell, put it up against your water bottle. It's not hard. People ask all the time, what do you use to hold your phone up? A fucking water bottle. That's it.
I love it. Yeah, that's even more practical. See, I'm too impractical. Hey, I'll say though, if the reason why somebody doesn't want to bring a tripod in is because it would make them uncomfortable, maybe that's a reason to do it.
Yeah,
maybe there's no good reason to be uncomfortable, because you know why you're recording yourself. You're not trying to become an Instagram influencer. You are recording it just for the purpose of checking your form. And I mean, for me, I don't think about it at all. I'm sure it makes me look weird, or I'm sure some people snicker behind my back about it, but that's totally fine.
I've had some people get mad if I am openly filming.
Really?
Oh yeah, yeah. When I lived in New York, never ever in Texas, but in New York there were times. There's one memory that's just mm-hmm. vivid in your head. There was one time where I was in a New York sports club and this woman was furious. She was like, "I better not be in this thing." Da da da. And I was like, "No, you're not. Like, you're nowhere near the frame." She was like, "Well, you should just turn." And she went and got the management. She was like, "He needs to stop filming." I was like, "If you had literally just asked me nicely from the beginning, I would have stopped. But now that you're this outraged over it and being so rude, I'm just gonna keep filming just to annoy you at this point." But yeah, some people get real mad about it.
That's interesting. I've never experienced that before.
but I
might not be as nice about it. I wouldn't lose my cool, but there's a point where I would just be like, I guess it sounds like maybe you out there, you're like, "Oh, okay. I don't care officially."
But yeah, the filming of the technique, that's one of the things that I think a lot of people get nervous about. I think a lot of people are worried about actually seeing what they look like while they're exercising. They're like, I don't even want to see myself. But it's like, no, it's so important. And in my opinion, it's way better than using a mirror while you're lifting. Because with the mirror, you can only get that one angle, which is just right in front of you. And you're missing out on, which I think the more important angle, which is from the side, usually you get a much better view of what your joints are doing and your overall body movement and placement. And when you're actually, you shouldn't be trying to watch your movement while you're doing the lift.
Right.
you don't want to be like twisting your spine and looking at the mirror to your side while you're squatting.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. And I don't even like looking for as far as like auditing my technique goes. When you're doing the squat, especially when it's heavy, that is not the time to try to edit your work on your technique. That is time to perform, right? Mm-hmm. And so, even if there is a mirror, I'm not looking at my gym. There's a mirror and then it ends. And that's why I look kind of down. I'm not even watching, myself. And then as far as what kind of thought to have, it's going to be, as far as performance goes, you want to get to a point where you can maybe just think of one simple cue. Like for example, explode out of the hole. That's all you're thinking about. You're getting down and you want to explode upward and push as hard as you can. And what you wouldn't want to be doing is trying to juggle, let's say, three internally focused things. Like, okay, I got to keep my knees here. I got to make sure that my hips and my shoulders rise at the same rate. And I got to make sure, that I reach depth as well. And so it's useful, particularly with warm-up sets. That's where it makes sense, I think, to focus on certain elements of your technique. And then you can see on camera what you're doing. And I understand that. I mean, I totally understand, because I play golf, not too much. I don't care to give it too much time, but I've put a fair amount of work into my swing, and it's a very technical movement. And there are a lot of things that you have to get just right for it to all work. And it can be frustrating to see on camera what you're actually doing, compared to just watching the ball. Like, there are a lot of people, they've figured out how to hit the ball and they can hit the ball decently well even, but technically it's very inefficient. And so it's very common with golfers. They do not like to look at their swing because they watch these people on TV, and it's so graceful with so many of these pros. And then they look at their swing, which, you know, it looks like a troll, like trying to bludgeon it's dinner or something. And so I do understand that, but fortunately with weightlifting, it's not golf. It's not nearly as hard to learn the proper squat technique. And, if you use your warm-up sets to really focus on what you're doing, and then you also use, if you also a good form of feedback is if you have a workout buddy, and if they know what they're doing, then you could also just do that and ask them to watch your form. But ultimately, I do think, like you said, it's very valuable for you yourself to see what you're doing and comparing it to what you think you're doing. That's the key. And then, so like something that I still do sometimes with heavier weights, deeper into sets with squats, is my knees will start to bow a little bit inward. It's not too exaggerated. It's not dangerous, but it's not optimal. It's not as efficient as far as, you really want your knees to just stay in place, pointing at your toes. That's proper form. It's probably mostly to prevent knee aggravation. And so that's something I still have to pay attention to. And I'll see on camera sometimes that if I don't pay attention to that, my knees will just like to move in a little bit just as I'm coming up. And so it helps to know that. And so I can, just know, okay, that's the one thing I'm going to think about as I'm coming out of the hole. All I'm going to think about is just twisting those feet into the ground outward. Kind of, they're not actually moving, but just screwing my feet into the ground, and that helps keep my knees where they need to be.
Yeah, like a little corkscrew motion where the feet don't actually move, but that's the thought process. It's sort of like the external cue you're using.
Yep.
Yeah. The other one I like to use sometimes in conjunction with that is spreading the floor apart, where you imagine there's a crack running in between your feet. And this is like, you can always tell when someone's coached people in person because they use these cues like this. But yeah, I would say imagine there's a crack in between your feet running through the floor, and underneath that crack, you just see a big pile of cash. And you want to open the crack up in order to get the cash, but you aren't allowed to use your hands. You have to use your feet to spread the floor open. That I found that helped a lot with preventing my knees from caving inwards.
Yeah, that's a good one.
So I want to talk more because I get questions about supplements all the time. And the last discussion you and I had here on the podcast got some really, really amazing feedback. And so you told me earlier that there is a supplement section in Muscle for Life, and considering you said it's almost exclusively for men and women 40 and above, could you talk a little bit about some of the supplements that you included in there and why you put them in there specifically for people in this age group?
Yeah. So they are the fundamentals, and so there is going to be some overlap probably with our last discussion. Like, for example, we have protein powder, mostly because it's convenient. It helps us hit our protein goals every day. And I would rather have a protein shake than eat another chicken breast personally. And many other people feel the same way.
Yeah. Especially if it's like 10 o'clock at night, you want to go to bed and you're down on protein. I'm not cooking a chicken breast. I'd rather just take a protein shake.
Yep, exactly. And then we have multivitamin, which I don't remember if we talked about last time, but that's to plug any nutritional gaps that may exist in our diet. And that's relevant even to people who eat well, because take vitamin D. If you are not supplementing with vitamin D, if you are not spending a fair amount of time in the sun, if you are not eating a lot of fortified foods that are fortified with vitamin D, which many people listening probably are not, because those tend to be more highly processed, less nutritious foods. Those tend to be foods that if you are eating them, they're a minority of your calories. You're just doing it because you like the cereal or, whatever it might be. And so a multivitamin is maybe you could think of it as like a smart insurance policy, quote unquote. And that would be on the vitamin and mineral side. And then a good multivitamin has more things in it than just vitamins and minerals, because why not? Because there are many other phytonutrients, for example, that we are probably not going to be getting in our diet, or certainly not going to be getting, that can help, that can improve health and in some case even performance. And many multivitamins, they don't have many of those things because they're expensive. Like, for example, a basic multivitamin that is just vitamins and minerals, you could get that done for probably $5 a bottle. But if you want to create a multivitamin with a fair amount of goodies in it, like mine, it's called Triumph, that costs me, I want to say right now, $15 a bottle probably to produce and get it into the hands. It might be even a little bit higher because of what's going on with COVID and the price of everything is going up. But that's just what it costs. It's expensive to do it right. And so that's on the list. Vitamin D is on the list. Many multivitamins have vitamin D, which they should, but some don't. And I wanted to make sure it was understood the importance of getting enough vitamin D, because it's a hormone. I mean, just about every cell in our body has receptors for vitamin D, and it impacts so many different aspects of our health and our well-being and our performance that we want to ensure that we are not deficient or insufficient in vitamin D. And a good baseline is 2000 IUs a day. Some people do need more. And to really know if you need more, unfortunately, you have to get a blood test and you have to look at your 25 hydroxy vitamin D levels is what it's called, because the vitamin D then gets your body processes it into this other molecule. And that's something that for those who, let's say they're taking 2000 IU per day and they are exhibiting symptoms that may be related to vitamin D, it wouldn't be a deficiency, but maybe an insufficiency, then it would be worth getting that done. But I will say that in most people, 2000 per day is fine. 5000 per day is fine. And for most people, I don't see a reason to go above that again, unless they've gotten blood testing and they know that their body just needs a lot of vitamin D to maintain sufficiency. Next up is fish oil, which I believe we spoke about. And the key there is, omega-3 fatty acids. And you could go with krill oil, but it's just more expensive. There's no benefit. That's why I don't sell krill oil, because I know it has a little bit of marketing pizzazz, but I don't think that's a reason to sell something. Fish oil works just fine. And there are different qualities of fish oil. And I went with a high quality one, but I don't see any reason to go with krill and ask people to pay an extra $10 to $15 a bottle to get the same thing done. And then we have creatine, which I know we spoke about. And if you are lifting weights, if you're doing any sort of resistance training, then you should take creatine. If you're going to take any supplements, which we should also probably just mention that I think good context for any supplement talk is you don't need supplements to do any of the stuff you want to do. You don't need to take supplements to build muscle, to lose fat, to get healthy, but the right ones can help. And so if you have the budget and you have the inclination, then what we're talking about is relevant. Some people, though, they don't want to. They just don't want to take pills and powders. Some people, they don't have the money to spend on it. And that's both of those reasons are totally valid to just skip supplements altogether. But again, for people who are okay with swallowing some pills every day and are okay with drinking some powder, hopefully tasty powder every day, then and they can afford it, then the advice in the first episode and this episode is really for them. And so with creatine, there also are, and if this is particularly relevant to people in their 40s and beyond, there is more and more research coming out showing that creatine can boost cognition and that not getting enough creatine in your diet can impair cognition. And if people are not eating a lot of meat, particularly a lot of red meat, they are probably not getting much creatine in their diet. And it's not an essential nutrient, of course, but it's safe. It's relatively inexpensive. Unfortunately, the costs of creatine in particular have skyrocketed in the last year or so, whey protein as well, but it's still affordable. And it is the most studied molecule in all of sports nutrition. It is exceedingly safe. Of course, some people don't respond. Some people don't gain muscle faster, don't gain strength faster. They don't recover better, but most people will. And so that's on the list. And then we have joint support, which is, again...
Wait, before we jump into joint support, I take your joint support, and it's helped a lot with jujitsu. But I want to talk a little bit about cognition, because in terms of creatine, I think most people who are remotely interested in taking creatine, they've heard the benefits about strength, they've heard the benefits about muscle growth, and they're aware of that. But I think a lot of people... what sort of might be the turning point for people is the cognitive benefits of creatine. So like, could you go into a little bit more detail? Like, what does that mean? Like, what does that mean? Creatine could enhance cognition.
Yeah. It is an interesting, I would say, maybe not turn of events, but it is an interesting observation that was made in research and then has been pursued, which really just comes to, a lot of it comes down to funding, is getting funding to look into things, right? And because the various types of disease and dysfunction that we can develop associated with brain health, because there are a lot of people who they don't want that to happen, or that is happening too, and there's a market there to help with that. That has helped fund more research into creatine. And so at this point, if you look at, for example, the higher levels of evidence, if you look at meta-analyses, which are studies of studies, basically, where they take a bunch of trials and they pool all the data and they look at the collective weight of the evidence, as opposed to just picking one trial. If you go trial by trial, it can be tough, because one trial could show efficacy, another one could not show efficacy, not because it's not effective, but because maybe there was a flaw in the trial design. And then, another one shows efficacy, another one shows no efficacy, and then you have a lot of efficacy and a little bit of efficacy, and it can be kind of confusing, like where does this stuff work or not? And so a meta-analysis helps again take all of those data points, aggregate them, and explain what message collectively they have. And then you also have research reviews as well. And what the research, what the current weight of the evidence shows is that it can improve short-term memory. It can improve intelligence. It can improve reasoning. So that could be measured in various ways, but like you could score higher on an IQ test by supplementing with creatine, and its effect in other cognitive domains is unclear. It may have additional benefits, particularly for older people, for people who are dealing with a lot of stress. And again, because it's safe and this has medical relevance, I think we're going to see more and more research into creatine. And I would not be surprised if it becomes just as common as a supplement among middle-aged people as maybe some sort of protein fortified food, maybe not a protein powder per se, but a lot of middle-aged people, you know, they're drinking some sort of protein fortified RTD, like ready to drink, for example, or glucosamine or other joint supplements that many middle-aged people take. And that would be great, because creatine, it would help with their body composition. It would help them retain muscle, retain mobility, retain strength. And it looks like it will also help them retain cognitive fitness as well.
You know, one thing I'm very interested to see in the future with research progressing on creatine is especially for older people and maybe those at risk of something like Alzheimer's, which that does run in my family, is seeing if something like creatine can help either delay the onset or help prevent it in the future, especially with cognitive benefits. I'm very, very interested to watch that to see if that comes out in research in the future.
Yeah. And the good news is, again, because it's safe and it's relatively inexpensive, we can all take it, and we'll see, you know, over the next 10 years or so, 5 or 10 years, how many more benefits researchers discover that we are already then enjoying, and there's no downside.
Yeah. Yeah. So go to joint support, because I know it was funny when I had never thought about taking a joint support supplement before. I'd never needed it. I never really had any issues with pain. And then I started jujitsu, and all of a sudden my fingers and my elbows, like this is a couple of years ago now, just started to really, really hurt. So I was like, you know what, screw it. I'll try the joint support. And I was really surprised with how much better it made me feel, and just how much it improved my overall, I'm not going to say my pain tolerance, but I think it reduced the amount of pain I was feeling in my joints.
Which is huge. I mean, it's huge for obviously your jujitsu. It's huge for your performance and your enjoyment of it. But then otherwise,
just quality of life.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, people often say they're as old as you feel, but in some ways, right, we're as old as our joints feel, because if any of our joints just feel off, then we feel older. You're trying to do your jujitsu workout or just a workout in the gym, and if something hurts enough, you simply can't do it. And of course, many people as they get older, they complain of joint problems. And so as far as supplementation goes, there are a few things that have good human evidence for efficacy, and they are not the ingredients that you often find in these supplements, like glucosamine. I was just looking at some research recently, and I think it's safe to say that the weight of the evidence on glucosamine is just meh. Like, you know, it might help a little bit in some people, but the benefits tend to be small. They tend to be inconsistent. Same thing goes for MSM and chondroitin. It's just these things are cheap, and so much marketing has already been done for them. Mm-hmm. And so many people, they haven't looked into it, but instinctively they just associate joint supplementation with glucosamine. Like, oh, if you're having joint problems, you just take glucosamine. Isn't that a thing, you know?
The marketing has been so good for, like, not only do I think of glucosamine, but I think of that image of like the blue joint with the red spot on it. You know, it's like,
yep,
all the commercials where, yep, it's like they show the shoulder that is in pain and everything's blue except the shoulder, which is red. And I think that's like literally what my brain goes to when I think glucosamine.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And it's been, I mean, I haven't looked at that specifically. I'm guessing, though, it's been decades, and a lot of money has been spent on raising awareness of glucosamine and selling, overselling its rather unimpressive benefits, really. I mean, and so that's why my joint supplement, which is what you've been taking, which is called Fortify, does not have glucosamine. It has a few things that you don't often see in joint supplements. And this is still a product that I understand it's not certainly not one of our best sellers. And many people, they even, no matter how much we talk about joint supplementation, they're not going to buy a joint supplement, and that's totally fine. Again, don't have to. I really like the product, though, because the formulation is just so good. It really is best in class, and it's expensive again, and that's one of the reasons. So as far as the ingredients go, one interesting ingredient is, it's called undenatured type 2 collagen. Now, collagen is very trendy these days. I do not sell a collagen protein supplement. I do not sell any kind of collagen supplement other than the 20 milligrams of type 2 undenatured, or undenatured type 2 collagen, that's in Fortify. And the reason is, collagen protein is just kind of trash to your protein, period. Its amino acid profile, it's just not very good. Like, look at the amount of leucine in a serving of, and let's just say the amount of essential amino acids, or branch chain, if you want to look at isoleucine and valine, in a serving of collagen protein, and then compared to whey. Whey is like over twice the amount of essential amino acids. And that's really, from a muscle building perspective, what we want from the protein.
Right.
And yeah, okay, the collagen protein, it's rich in glycine, and that may help you look a little bit prettier. It may improve hair, skin, and nail quality. But you can just buy glycine in bulk. It's cheap and it tastes good. And you could take 2 to 3 grams at night before you go to bed. It may even improve sleep quality, and it may or may not make you look prettier, but you don't have to spend the money on the collagen protein to get the glycine. You can just go over straight for the glycine, right? But this undenatured type 2 collagen is interesting because, one, it's very expensive. This stuff is not in any collagen protein, or most collagen supplements do not contain it, because just to put 20 milligrams in each bottle, I'm going to guess, I think it costs about $4 to $5 a bottle just to put 20 milligrams of this stuff in the supplement. And what it is type 2 collagen is the type that makes up your joint cartilage, and undenatured often is just a marketing buzzword. Like in the case of protein, it's just a marketing buzzword. But in this case, it's actually very important, because what it means is that it's in its more natural form. It hasn't been processed with chemicals or heat that change its chemical structure to something that does not exist in nature. And this is very important here because research, they've done studies on denatured types of collagen, and they have found no beneficial effects on joint inflammation. So specifically, it needs to be undenatured. And what do we see with undenatured? Well, we see that it is very effective for regulating the immune response that causes joints to become inflamed, that causes cartilage and bone to wear away. So this is rheumatoid arthritis, for example. And this immune response, what happens is, so we do things with our body, and we use our joints, and it causes inflammation. And our body then, it actually attacks the joint cartilage. It treats it like a foreign invader. And this happens in people with healthy joints. And of course, if it happens too much and for too long, then we have unhealthy joints. And so what is very cool about type 2 collagen, undenatured type 2, is that research has shown that it has benefits for both people with and without healthy joints. And that there aren't too many things. There are a few others that we can touch on briefly, but there aren't too many joint-related supplements that you could honestly pitch to people with healthy joints.
Dude, every time I talk with you, I learned so much. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, 100%.
And one other ingredient, we don't have to go through the whole formulation, but one other that is particularly good that I'm sure has been one of the big players in your benefits is curcumin. And this is the orange pigment that is in the turmeric plant. And so that's the main spice in curry. And this pigment has been used in Ayurvedic medicine for thousands of years, and it has many different health benefits. I mean, right now, scientists around the world are investigating its effects on a variety of diseases. They're looking at cancer, cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis, diabetes, Alzheimer's, you mentioned that, and others. And as far as joints go, what it is particularly good at is reducing inflammation, which then also helps relieve pain and relieve stiffness and improve mobility. And it does that by inhibiting an enzyme that causes inflammation called cyclooxygenase. COX is how it's generally, COX is how it's generally referred to. And so that is something, again, that benefits people with healthy joints, benefits people with joint issues, and it has other health benefits, which is pretty cool. And generally, when we're formulating supplements, we're always looking for ingredients that do provide the primary benefits that we're after, but also have secondary benefits as well.
That makes total sense. That's awesome. And just for everyone listening, just in case you want, if you go to I'll put a link in my show notes where you could get 20% off your first order with Legion. That's who I get all my supplements from. Before we started recording, you mentioned something about DHEA.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about that?
Yeah, let's talk about that briefly, because this is something that I get asked about now and then, because it's often sold as a testosterone booster. And there are some studies that would seem to suggest that it does boost testosterone levels. If you were to read the abstracts, for example, I could see how some people would read a few of these things and think, hey, this is a testosterone booster. And that's not accurate, because so what DHEA is, it's a hormone that's produced by our adrenal glands, and in supplements it's created from substances that are in yams and soy, I believe those are the most common sources. So they take some molecules and then they fiddle with them, and then they can create DHEA, and our body converts DHEA into male and female sex hormones, including testosterone and estrogen. And what studies show is that our natural production of DHEA, it peaks in our early 30s, and then it just gradually declines as we get older. And so then what studies show, if you look at the details of the studies that would seem to suggest it is an effective testosterone booster, is that it can increase testosterone production in older men and estrogen production in older women. And so that, yeah, so really I like to, I mean, we sell a product, it's called Vitality, and it has DHEA, and I do not sell it as a testosterone booster, a hormone booster. I think more accurately, it's described as something that can just improve your hormone profile if you are, call it 40, probably 40 and beyond is when people tend to start noticing benefits, if they are going to notice benefits. And that is the case with all natural supplements. No matter how much research there is on a molecule indicating efficacy, there are some people who don't respond. Like, take creatine. Some people, they just get nothing from creatine, but most people do. And so in this case, DHEA is a great supplement. There are no downsides. It doesn't shut down your natural production of anything. There are no negative side effects. It is not the same as taking testosterone, for example, or taking estrogen, because it simply gives your body more of something that it uses to create testosterone and estrogen. And if you give it more than it needs, it simply excretes it. It doesn't then create an imbalance in hormone production like you can create if you just inject testosterone or inject estrogen. So I think it's a no-brainer for people who are 40 and beyond, even if they are not noticing any symptoms of low testosterone or low estrogen, what they may notice with DHEA is a slight increase in mood, maybe slightly better sleep, maybe a little bit better performance in the gym. No body composition effects. That would be dishonest to say that, hey, if you take this stuff, you're going to get more jacked. No, that's not going to happen. If you inject a bunch of testosterone, which I would not recommend, I would not recommend that. But yes, that works for sure. That gets you jacked. DHEA is more about health and well-being than body composition.
Got it. That makes sense. Now I have a question. I just thought of this one because I get asked this a lot on my Q&As. Because a lot of everyone knows, like, I support you. I support Legion. I get asked a lot about Legion's fat burner because I am, like, very loudly a proponent of, like, fat burners are bullshit, right? Listen, I have no problem saying this to someone that I love and really appreciate, saying I disagree with you on this, but I want to hear from you. Tell me about Legion's fat burner, because I think a lot of the people who follow my content have been waiting for this. They've been like, all right, are they going to talk about it? Since fat burners don't work. And then
cross swords. Go.
Yeah. So I was like, you know what? Like, let's just talk about it. I just want to hear, like, tell us about Legion's fat burner.
Oh, this is a common, I'm seeing this as a common, topic, I guess you could say, on social media. I don't spend too much time, but I've seen more and more people use fat burners as just kind of like archetypal example of what's wrong with the supplement industry. And I do understand that because of how so many fat burners are sold. So many are sold as literal miracle pills, that if you just take these pills, you don't have to care about how you eat, and you're going to lose 10, 20, 30 pounds in your first 30 days. And there's a lot of money to be made in that, simply because there are many unsophisticated consumers, not stupid, just unsophisticated. And we have all been that unsophisticated consumer. I was once that person. I would go into, when I was 19, I would go into GNC and ask the sales guy, what are the newest and best supplements? You know, I thought that maybe I didn't think very much about it. I just accepted the kind of narrative that there's all this proprietary research going on and it's very scientific, and the stuff in the back, the stuff in the back under lock and key, that's, it's not steroids, of course, but that's the really good stuff. And so those
like locked glass cases in the back of Vitamin Shop and GNC were the smartest marketing ploy like ever. It just made me want them even more, where you had to go get the guy to unlock like the XXX test booster fat burner.
I remember what was it? It was the test bomb, like 2000. I remember I was so excited for this stuff. I was like, this is going to be great. And you know, what's ironic is, and now I know some of the tricks of the trade, so to speak, is some of those products, some of those natural testosterone boosters, they almost certainly had small amounts of androgens in them. I remember one in particular I look back on it, I was like, I don't think anything natural, because I really actually noticed a difference with these. They were, I don't remember the name of it. It was just supposed to be a natural testosterone booster, and it really made a significant difference. Not in terms of muscle gain. I just noticed like quite a bit more energy, a nice little bump of strength in the gym. Wow. Okay. The crazy Indian herbs or whatever. Yeah, I don't know. So what companies, I'm sure they're still doing it. The trick is, so you put small amounts of androgens or you change them chemically a little bit to have the same effect in the body, but they're not technically the androgen. And then you release the product, and then you let it generate word of mouth. Because fitness.
Oh my God! No way.
Yeah, and then you take the androgen out, and you just ride that wave until it fizzles out, and then you retire the product, and you do it again with something else, and so you can't get caught. So it's just that first, that first batch is the spiked batch. Maybe you do another spiked batch again, just to build up that word of mouth. And then every batch produced from there on out doesn't have the illegal substance in it. So if the FDA ever comes knocking, and unless they can get their hands on an original first batch, there's no evidence of wrongdoing.
Wow, that is crazy.
It happens. It happens. But back to fat burners. So there are many fat burners that are useless. A lot of them have stuff that we know doesn't work. Like, it's very cheap. And again, it's kind of like glucosamine, but even worse. Garcinia Cambogia. If you see that in any fat burner, do not buy it. And not only that, don't buy anything from that company. Really. Because either they don't know what they're doing or they are dishonest. And why would you buy from a company that doesn't know what they're doing, especially when you are ingesting their products?
Yeah.
Or they are dishonest, because you could just head over to PubMed, just put in Garcinia Cambogia weight loss, and you can find multiple meta-analyses, multiple research reviews that shows it does not work in humans. It works in rats, and so it was once promising, but then it completely flopped in human research. Raspberry.
That's the issue. Like, I've gotten so many discussions about this with people in recent days. I don't know what it was the last couple of days, but the amount of people who are using rat studies as equivalent to studies on humans. I'm like, why would you use a rat study when we have human studies showing this? Like, that it doesn't work in humans. It's that people forget that rats aren't humans.
Well, we share 99% of DNA. I mean, so what's good for the rat, it's got to be good for me. The burn thermogenic extreme weight loss people, they say that it's great. I mean, acetyl L-carnitine is another one. You'll find that in any form of carnitine in a fat burner, red flag, because we know that it can have positive effects on recovery and on muscle soreness, but not on fat burning. That was also something, there was rat research that indicated maybe it could increase calorie burning. And there was some, let's say, mechanistic kind of meandering about, how that could be true. But then human studies showed that it didn't increase weight loss. CLA, conjugated linoleic acid.
That's
another one. Anyone who sells that stuff, just don't buy anything from them, because we know that it not only seems to be a flop, like the weight of the evidence is it's not going to help you lose fat faster. There's at least one study, if not two or three, that showed people actually gained weight when they were taking it, which I'm not saying that it directly caused. I mean, obviously there aren't many calories in it, but it is interesting that it resulted in weight gain. So we look at the result of the trial. Well, that's the actual opposite of what we want, right? So that's another one. Stay away from that. And any company that sells that, I know it's not a fat burner, but I'm going to say BCAAs, branched chain amino acids. Also, the number one most requested supplement that Legion that we get is BCAAs. We get people every single, maybe even every day at this point, certainly every week, asking for them. And we don't sell them, and I don't think we ever will sell them, because there's just no reason to take them. But there just isn't. I mean, and we have a simple response that we give to people explaining to them. I even have a long form article explaining this. I'm going to add in our store a section that is just going to be stuff we don't sell. And then I can explain to people, this is why we don't sell BCAAs. This is why we don't sell a testosterone booster or growth hormone booster. This is why we don't sell collagen protein. This is why we don't sell a hydration electrolyte supplement. really. Those are also useless. And so let's talk fat burners.
I was thinking, I know you'd appreciate this. We have to do the change my mind segment, right? Mike, I think fat burners are bullshit. All of them, yes. Including yours. Change my mind.
Okay, good. So I'm gonna agree with you that one, most fat burners are actually just bullshit. They are not going to, they have some caffeine, but what's ironic about that is most people are so used to having caffeine that they are desensitized to it, and it's not going to have any meaningful metabolic effects anymore, right? It has the sleep blocking effects. It never loses that. The adenosine blocking, but as far as boosting your metabolism, that's a short, you get that for a little bit until your body just gets used to it, and that's the end of it. And so even that is not helpful if we're talking about burning calories. So yes, most fat burners are useless. And I'm also going to say that you do not need a fat burner at all. And even a good fat burner, and we can go into some of the specifics of mine. And I would say it's a good fat burner for what fat burners can do. And I don't even honestly like the term. I don't like calling it a fat burner, but maybe it'd be better as metabolic support, appetite support. But the problem with that is people don't know what that means.
Correct. And then it boils down to getting people the product.
Exactly. And doing it in an honest way. But again, part of marketing is you have to meet people where they are. And when somebody is like, I want to lose weight and I want a supplement that can help, even if it's just a little bit, they immediately say, I want a fat burner or I want a weight loss supplement. They do not say, I want a metabolic support supplement. You know what I mean? Maybe appetite suppressant, but that's its own, that's kind of niche. And so, even a good fat burner is, I think, and this is based on the research on the ingredients in mine, if you combine it with proper diet and proper exercise, I do think it's reasonable to say that if you were to take my fat burner every day, you could lose up to maybe an extra pound or two a month. Two might be stretching it, but I don't think that's completely unreasonable. And so the question then is that worth it to you? And we can get into the specifics of why I think that's the case. But some people, they go, nah, an extra pound a month? That's not very exciting. What's exciting is the bullshit is 10 right. pounds in a month, 20 pounds. Yeah, that's
exactly.
That's exciting. But a pound, and I'm putting my wallet away. You know what I mean?
Do you think that one of the major reasons that your product might help, which realistically, when I hear it, even a pound and a half extra a month for most people sounds incredible to me, because I know how much people struggle. And my mind immediately goes to the people who struggle with consistency specifically related to hunger. And hunger, I've been very interested with hunger, and some people, they manage their hunger. It's not really a massive issue for them. But for other people, hunger is a real, real issue. And I've always been very intrigued by the differences individual to individual and how much hunger can impact certain people. And also, if you're more hungry, obviously you're going to end up eating more. Do you think that the specifics of your product, the reason why it might help so much is it lends to higher consistency because of reduced hunger?
Yeah, that is a huge predictor, of course, of dietary success is just generally how hungry are you? And if you are generally pretty hungry, if most of your waking hours are hungry hours, then it is very hard, if not impossible, to succeed, especially if you have a lot of weight to lose. And this isn't just going to be a 2 or 3 week mini cut or something. So in the case of Legion's fat burner, which is called Phoenix, the formulation, the core of it is you have a couple of ingredients that have been shown to increase calorie burning. So just increase calorie expenditure. We have Thai ginseng, we have grains of paradise. And if anybody wants to fact check me on that, they can either, they can go searching for the research, or they can look on, I've written all of the copy personally that is on Legion's website. Every product has every product page. All that copy is written by me. And I really try to explain to people what each ingredient is, how it works, a little bit of a mechanistic explanation without just hitting them over the head with a bunch of jargon to try to sound smart. I do want them to understand simply why this thing, like what is it doing in my body? And then what the benefits are. And each of those benefits are bullet pointed with studies that people can go check out for themselves. And I do often hear from people who have access to the journals. Some of the research you can access for free. Some of it is would be behind a paywall, but you can use Sci-Hub if you want to get around that. You'll have to, I forget the domain extension. It's another country. It's changed a couple of times, but you can find it if you look for Sci-Hub. And so you can pull up those papers and you can see for yourself. And so that obviously helps just burning, maybe upward of 150 extra calories per day. I think you could stretch to say maybe 200 additional calories per day. And so that helps a little bit. And then there's the hunger side of things. And so, for example, there is it's a cactus, and it's edible, and it's found primarily in India. Caralluma fimbriata, I believe. I might be mispronouncing that, but that's going to be close. Some of these ingredients, you know, some of the pronunciations are not intuitive. But this is an interesting. It's just an interesting plant, because research shows that it can reduce appetite, it can reduce stress and cortisol levels, which then can further decrease the desire to overeat. And this is something that has been used traditionally in India for a long time. This is one of those things that scientists eventually, they found that people were using this cactus. It was when food was scarce, and it would help blunt their appetite, and it would help them get through these periods of semi-starvation. And so then they started to look into it, and well, what happens if we supplement with it? And those are the effects that that have been seen. And there's more research being done on it. But again, several well-designed, well-executed human studies. And also, there is something to be said for that anecdotal evidence too, that again, it's been used traditionally in India for a long time, and that is how it has been used. So that's something that can help reduce appetite. There's also something in Phoenix called 5-HTP, and that is, it's a compound that's produced when your body metabolizes the amino acid tryptophan, and that's found in stuff like milk and meat and pumpkin, turkey. And that's then converted into serotonin in the brain. And of course, that's one of the big neurotransmitters, and it's involved in feelings of happiness. And so what research has shown is that when you supplement with 5-HTP, it can support your mood, which can reduce the desire to overeat, because many times the desire to eat is not physiological. And an easy way to know whether it is or not is if you're feeling a desire to eat something, you might call it hunger, but ask yourself if you would have the same desire to eat, let's just say, a bowl of cooked beans. Like you want to eat maybe something very palatable, but if the idea of just eating a handful, whatever, a bowl of cooked beans, if that turns you off, if you wouldn't eat it, then it's probably more psychological in nature than physiological, than physical in nature. If you would go for the beans, like I'm kind of hungry right now, and I would eat the beans and I would like them. Like the idea of eating beans, that sounds good right now, right? So that's an indicator. That's an indicator of that. Okay, it probably is biological hunger.
I have the same thing. I used to call this the apple test with my clients. I'd be like, "Are you hungry enough to eat an apple?" No. All right. Well, then you're definitely not actually hungry.
Then definitely. That's a good one. Yeah. Cause hey, apples are pretty, like, I mean, Honeycrisp apples, those are delicious.
They're delicious. They're amazing. Like it's like nature's candy. I have very few people don't actually enjoy an apple. So if you're not hungry enough to eat an apple, then it's, you just want a snack. And this is actually something else that I want to get more into and talk about more. Maybe you and I could do another episode about it, is about palatable foods and understanding the psychological aspect of just, it's so easy just to get more and more and more and mindlessly eat them and convince yourself that you're hungry when in reality you're not.
Very true. Yeah. I just had an interesting discussion with Menno Henselmans on that subject on my podcast. That could make a great episode.
So from what it sounds like,
Let me just say one more thing let me just say on 5-HTP, because not only does it support mood, it also, research shows that it can increase feelings of fullness. So it can help you just feel fuller from the foods that you eat. And of course, that then helps you reduce your food intake or control your food intake. And finally, it has been shown to reduce cravings for carbs in particular. And so interesting, and of course, because it positively affects brain chemistry, there are all kinds of interesting things that can happen because of that. And so there are a couple of other ingredients in Phoenix, but those are some of the bigger movers, so to speak. And I stand by selling a fat burner, and really, I don't sell BCAAs, even though I could make a lot of money with it.
Yeah, I feel like it would be a bestseller, to be honest.
I mean, there's a whole, it would be one of my bestsellers without a doubt. And people, it's funny that when they reach out to our customer experience people, they'll ask, hey, why don't you sell BCAs? Or are you going to sell BCAs? And then there's a canned response that just quickly explains why. And it's funny that many people, they appreciate that and they go, oh, okay, cool. I didn't know that. I thought they were useful. But they still want us, they'll say like, well, you know, I really do like the tasty water though. So if you do ever make a BCA, if that's all it is tasty water, I'll buy yours.
Bro, it's funny because I have colleagues in the industry who like they take BCAAs every day and I'm like, you do know, like you eat plenty of protein. You don't need that. They're like, yeah, I know. I just like the tasty water. And it's crazy to me because I'm like, that's really expensive tasty water though. Like you could get tasty water without spending that much money.
I know. And if depending on how much water how much tasty water they're drinking, and depending on what product they're using, if they're using an artificially sweetened and food dyed product, and I'm not an alarmist about those things at all, but if they're having like 10 to 12 servings of artificial sweeteners and food dyes every day, 7 days a week, it's probably not great for their health. And again, I'm not going to say that it's going to cause cancer or it's going to cause weight gain or a lot of the other things that the artificial alarmists will say, but I do think that the current weight of the evidence supports the statement that it's probably not best for your gut health and some other aspects of your health to have that much of that stuff every day, always.
Well, that's also, I mean, that sort of, it's not in moderation anymore if you're having that much, right? Like if you're having 10 to 12 servings of that every day, 7 days a week, not to mention, and I think this, I'm getting more and more interested in this stuff as well. If you can't drink regular water without needing it to be sweet, that's not good, right? Like, and I've been digging more into dopamine response, into why we have these certain behaviors. And I very much think that if you feel like you need to have something sweet, that's something that needs to be addressed. It's like, don't just continue to, oh, well, I need something sweet, so I'm going to keep sweetening my water. It's like, or you could just try to have regular water, and sooner than you think, you might get used to it and actually enjoy it.
And you know, I just recorded a podcast, just a monologue, me talking about sugar addiction. This is I took this inspiration. I do a series that I got from inspiration from you, which is I ask people to give me something that on social media usually give me something they disagree with me on, and then I pick topics that are topical or just that interest me, and I'll address them on the podcast. And so that's one of them. And a lot of talking about rat research, a lot of the research used to support that argument that sugar is addictive in the same way as hardcore drugs.
Yeah,
a lot of that research is rat research, and the human research tends to go in the other direction. And of course, though, that is not to say that sugar is the same as any other type of food. No, it's not. But anyways, I don't want to get us off on a complete tangent, but it's just that point of sweetness and of, it's not even necessarily the calories, right?
So correct.
It could be the artificial sweetener also triggers the same feelings and maybe compulsions as the sugar. And that's actually been seen in rats too. I talk about this in the episode that I think it's probably more likely that rats, they don't get addicted to sugar. So it's actually the sweet, because they've shown the addictive like behaviors with saccharin, for example, which is a calorie-free sweetener. And they also select for these rats that particularly love sweet stuff. And so rats seem to, they can get addicted to sweets in a similar way as drugs, but it does not appear to work like that in humans, even though, again, we can really like to eat the sweet stuff. And we can feel compelled to eat the sweet stuff. But fortunately, we don't have to try to overcome the same maybe amount of biological resistance to change that a drug addict has to overcome to try to, you know, stop.
Correct. That's
snorting
exactly.
cocaine. And so I try to make it a positive message, you know, try to empower people. Like if you are struggling with sugar, I think reframing your relationship with that food can help you balance it and no longer struggle with it.
I agree 100%. And it's, I just made a story about this the other day. A lot of people got really pissed off at me for saying literally what you just said. But I think when they hear, oh, sugar is addictive, all of a sudden they use that as a justification to not change their eating habits. Like, well, I'm addicted. I'm just addicted to sugar. So that's it, said and done. I'm addicted. And then in my mind, I'm like, well, what would you tell a struggling alcoholic who's really like trying to improve their relationship and eliminate alcohol or be able to drink it in more appropriately in moderation? We just tell them like, well, you're addicted to alcohol, so like might as well just give up. It's like, of course not. It's like you would do anything in your power to overcome that addiction. So it's actually a really good thing to know that you do not have that same physiological addiction that you might have to a harder drug or an alcohol or cigarettes or anything like that.
Yep. Yep. And you know, you could say, hey, I really like this stuff. Or maybe I really, really like this stuff. Totally, totally understand. And there are many reasons to really like this stuff. But anybody who is struggling with really liking this stuff and eating too much of it, I believe in that, in really do. And I've seen it firsthand. I'm sure you have. I've seen so many people completely reconstruct their relationship with food and really make a complete 180 degree change. Maybe it's in phases, of course, but anybody who is currently struggling and feels like they are addicted to sugar, I think if they want to make a change and they understand how to make a change and how to do it in an enjoyable and sustainable way, they can do it and they can get to a point where they no longer struggle with sugar and they can have some, and that doesn't mean never having it again either.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All right. Before we get off, Mike, is there anything you want to end with? Could you just tell people about your book again and when and where they can get it and where they can follow you?
Yeah, absolutely. So the book is Muscle for Life, and muscleforlifebook.com is the place to go if you want to participate in the big book launch bonanza that I have going. I'm giving away over $12,000 and stuff, and we're still reaching out to companies, and I still have like a month and a half, so I'm going to see if I can get it to $20,000 and stuff. And people can enter the giveaway by buying the book, of course, and forwarding us the receipt, and they can get extra entries by buying additional copies of the book. And I'm giving away also free gifts to people who buy any amount of copies. So they're guaranteed to get some cool stuff and they get entries in the giveaway. And so, yeah, that's at muscleforlifebook.com. And otherwise, I guess my online hub is really Legion's website. That's where I write for the blog over at legionathletics.com. There's an article going up from me every week or so, every 7 to 10 days, sometimes a little bit more frequently, usually not less frequently than that. And my podcast is also over there. It's under the learn part of the menu. So you'll see blog and then podcast. And I have other books as well, but that all of it is over at Legion's website.
Yeah. And for everyone listening, again, if you want to get, if you want to experiment with some of Mike's podcasts at Legion Athletics, or some of Mike's supplements, excuse me, at Legion Athletics, you can go link in the description for 20% off. You can use the code SYATT, S-Y-A-T-T.
And you don't have to get the fat burner. You can leave the fat burner.
or you can, like, let's say, and actually I meant to talk about that. Like if you struggle with hunger, if you struggle with feeling like you're hungry all the time, that might be something worth experimenting with to see if that changes, right? I think the image that fat burner puts in people's heads is, oh, I take this pill and it will literally burn the fat off of my bones. And so that's where it's like, no, this is not how that works. So
have you seen the companies that they do the AM and the PM fat burners too. They get you twice.
Yeah, so they go double as fast, and you got to go back and get more quickly. Mike, this was awesome. Thank you for coming on. I really appreciate you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again for having me.
Of course, man. I'll talk to you soon.
That wraps it up for this episode of the Jordan Syatt Mini Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And Mike, thank you so much for coming on. I hope you have a wonderful day. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a 5-star review. It really does help a lot. And if you'd like to join the Inner Circle, you can do that at the link in the show notes or www.sfinnercircle.com. Have a wonderful day, and I'll talk to you soon.